Welcome to Archway's Western Civilization History Podcast. In our podcast, we look for the best of the West and discuss the stories, events, themes, and people that made the West different from the rest. This week is my wife's birthday. To honor that, I want to focus this episode on one of her hobbies. She shudders at the thought of living in medieval times, but ironically, because of her skill in this hobby, she would have fit right in with the medieval European nobility, monks, commoners, and even the Knights Templar. The hobby I'm talking about is chess. And of course, it isn't just enjoyed by my wife and medieval Europeans. It's a hobby beloved throughout the entire world. In fact, it is the world's most popular board game. Especially after the pandemic, the ease of playing chess online, the hit Netflix show The Queen's Gambit, and Twitch turning chess into an esport, chess has been going through a popularity high that doesn't seem to be dying down. Before 2020, chess.com had 30 million members. In 1 year, this doubled, and by the end of 2021, they reached 75 million members. Players of chess like Hikaru have more than doubled the amount of followers they have on social media during this same time period. And after the Queen's Gambit released, sales of strategy books on chess soared 603%, and chess set sales went up 125%. But where did this strategy game originate from, and how has it changed since its beginnings? And what impact has it had on the world, especially Western civilization? Marcel Duchat, in an address to the New York State Chess Association in 1952, gives us an idea of the import of this game. Quote, "The chess pieces are the block alphabet which shapes thoughts, and these thoughts, although making a visual design on the chessboard, express their beauty abstractly like a poem." The idea of chess originated in India during the reign of the Gupta Empire. There, in the 6th century AD, evolved a game called Chaturanga. Chaturanga is the precursor of chess because it innovated two distinctively chess-y features, making it different from other ancient games like checkers and go, namely, having different pieces with different powers, and having victory depend on the fate of one piece, the king. Chaturanga, in Sanskrit, means having four parts, and was a reference to the four parts of an army: the infantry, the elephants, the chariots, and the horsemen. These pieces were the progenitors to the pawns, bishops, rooks, and knights, respectively. Chaturanga also had an advisor piece, who is now represented by the queen in modern chess. Chariots, or rooks, and horsemen, or knights, moved the same way in Chaturanga as they do now. But the elephants moved very differently from the bishops. Elephants could only move 2 squares sideways, unlike a bishop, which can travel diagonally up to any obstacle. Also, unlike the queen, the advisor could only move 1 square diagonally. This is comparatively very underpowered in respect to the queen, who could travel across the board. Lastly, the foot soldiers of Chaturanga could only move 1 space forward, unlike a pawn, which can move 2 spaces forward at the start of a game, and it captures pieces diagonally. Like modern chess, Chaturanga was a strategy game. But more than that, it was also for wargaming purposes, mocking up the military strategy at the time. In India, they were known for using all four of those elements, even elephants, in warfare very frequently. By the 7th century, the game had spread throughout India and was becoming very popular, in spite of, or maybe because of, a period of peace and prosperity. The game soon started to spread to India's trading partners in Malaysia, the Himalayas, China, Korea, and Japan. These civilizations' versions soon diverged greatly from modern chess we're familiar with. But the Chaturanga also spread westward, and it came into Sassanid Persia, where it would be a game that would grow into the chess that we're familiar with now. The Persians called this game Chaturang. It was played on an 8x8 board and had the same starting configuration of 32 pieces as modern chess, with the exception of the king piece, which they called the Shah. The white Shah could be placed on either D1 or E1. Wherever the white Shah was, the black Shah had to match that same file. The Persians added many new rules to the game, ones which have become iconic to us now. One of the most famous Persian additions was having to declare Shah, meaning king, when threatening your opponent's king, and Shah Mat, meaning the king is helpless, when your opponent's king was stuck. Shah-mat would later be transliterated to checkmate. The Persians also hammered out how the elephants would work, settling on letting him move diagonally instead of sideways. The Persians thoroughly enjoyed chess, and they even respected its players. A 6th century literary romance told of a great hero who was also exceptionally skilled at chess. Ardashir, with the help of the gods, became more victorious and experienced than all others in polo, horsemanship, chess, backgammon, and all other arts. As the Persians joined the Islamic world and helped form the Abbasid Empire, chess continued to be played and spread throughout the region. Thousands of records of games, books of strategy, and books of puzzles have been found from this era, proving that chess was enjoyed by kings, philosophers, and commoners. Famously, the Khalifa, Muhammad al-Amin, was playing chess as his brother besieged his capital at Baghdad. As the walls of his city crumbled, al-Amin could not be bothered to end his chess game. Messengers begged him to tell them what the strategy should be to defend the city, but al-Amin was engrossed in defending his Shah. This would be al-Amin's last chess game, for al-Amin and the messengers would all be beheaded as the palace was breached. From the Islamic world, chess traveled into Europe via two different routes simultaneously. It spread from the east through the Byzantines, and it spread through the south via the Spanish and Italian merchants interacting with the Muslim traders across the Mediterranean. Because of these disparate origins, chess terms actually became quite different in different parts of Europe. You can see these differences even to this day. In Spanish and Portuguese, chess is called ajedrez or jadrez, which is derived from the Arabic and Persian shatranj. In most other languages, the game's name is derived from the Persian word for the king piece, shah. So in Dutch, it's called shakan. In French, it's chéquen. And in English, it's chess. You'll notice that the French word for shah sounds like check, and you'd be right. This has led to the somewhat ironic fact that both the words chess and check are actually derived from the same term. But because of the way the game spread throughout Europe, it made it seem like they were separate terms, kind of like playing the game telephone. The Europeans also had different names for the other pieces as well. Every European nation used their own term for the king piece: roi, rei, rex, konig, king, etc. Interestingly, every chess player was united worldwide in recognizing that this shah piece represented a king. But from there, the names and interpretation of other chess pieces dramatically diverged. One thing is that the Europeans early on, they abandoned calling the vizier or the advisor piece by that name. Universally, it became known as the dame, la dama, la regina, and the queen. It soon became much more powerful and was allowed to move diagonally two squares instead of one. Later, the modern move of the queen developed in Spain during Isabella I's reign in the late 1400s. Perhaps Spanish chess players in court were inspired by their queen's great political power. Regardless, the idea of a powerful queen carried across the continent like wildfire, because of the printing press and because of the 1492 expulsion of the Jews during the Spanish Inquisition. These Spanish Jews in exile carried the new chess rules with them wherever they fled. Meanwhile, the Gupton chariot piece that the Indians called Ratha and the Persians called Ruk developed a very new name and form. A big reason for this was that in the Islamic culture, you were forbidden from idolatry. This means that you're not allowed to make any likeness of anything in the heavens above or the earth beneath. So the chess pieces had to be very abstract, basic forms, making them quite ambiguous as to what they were supposed to be depicting. You could not carve a piece to look like a chariot, and so it looked kind of like a tall blob with a wedge cut into it where presumably a chariot rider was supposed to sit. In France, they mistook this wedge as a representation of battlements of a tower, and there was no other explanation as to why this piece was so tall, and so the French called this le tour. Likewise, the Greeks called it prigos, and the Spanish said torre. And the Germans, they called it a term. But for whatever reason, the English, they kept the Arabic/Persian word, rook. In spite of it still being called a chariot in English, nevertheless, no Englishman can deny that the rook piece has taken on a very tower-like form. And if you think about it, it would really make much more sense for a king to send a chariot out to move across the battlefield like that in a straight line, since towers can't move. Nevertheless, that's what we ended up with, a piece called rook, meaning chariot, and it's designed like a tower. Anyway, in the case of the bishop, things went quite differently. This time, the Icelandic, Celts, and English people were responsible for its huge divergence from the Persian piece. The Persians called this piece alfil, meaning elephant. Likewise, the Italians and Spanish called it their derivations, alfiere in Italian and alfil in Spanish. But when the northern Europeans saw the grooves engraved on the abstract-looking Persian pieces representing the elephant's tusks, they mistook these for a ceremonial hat, also called a mitre, of their priests. So imagine the Pope's hat. And so that's why in northern Europe they started calling this piece the bishop. While some bishop pieces are clearly made to look like a mitre and even have a little cross in them, it's still not uncommon to see bishop pieces that have what appear to be two curved tusks on the top of them. As chess became standardized, these tusks came to be represented by a simple groove cut into the piece. And so that's why if you look at a standard chessboard, the bishop has a wedge cut into its head. But yeah, I don't think the elephant and battle concept traveled very well into Europe. In other Germanic languages, they thought that the piece was supposed to be a messenger or a courier, and they called it that. In some Slavic languages, it's called an archer, and others called it their word for an officer in the army. In India and Mongolia, they actually call it a camel. Crazily enough, though, the Russians got the concept, and so they call bishops their word for elephant, slon. But the biggest slap in the face is that the French call the bishop le fou, meaning the jester. Well, how did that happen? Well, I'll explain something in a little bit that will make that make more sense. But for now, let's go on and talk about the horsey. The cavalry piece, known as faraz, which is the Arabic word for a mare, a female horse, it translated pretty well into Europe. Most European languages call this a horse or a horse rider, as in French and English, who say cavalier and knight, respectively. Likewise, the infantry piece, bayduk in Arabic, was translated into European languages as peon or pawn, meaning a foot soldier. Or in some Germanic and Slavic languages, this became the word for commoner. This makes sense because in these cultures, commoners would often be conscripted to be the frontline troops. So now that you have an idea where these pieces started getting their names, shapes, and identities, let's talk about some of the rules that the Europeans introduced. One thing you'll notice in reading the literature is that, in general, the Europeans felt that this game was very slow and very long and could be a little uninteresting. Quote, "The game was a status symbol, and excellence at the game a point of pride, but it was not universally loved. The restrictions of some of the pieces, including the pawn moves, apparently led to a slower, longer game. One writer describes the weariness which players experience from the long duration of the game played right through." Close quote. So, naturally, the Europeans began experimenting with ways to speed up the game and to spice it up. To speed it up, obviously, they supercharged the queen piece, giving her the power of both rook and bishop. They also allowed the pawns to move two spaces in the beginning. With this rule also came the infamous 15th century caveat, en passant. You should Google that, because I don't have the brains or the willpower to address it here. Another move to speed things up was castling, allowing players to get the king to safety and the rooks into action much earlier on in the game. To spice the game up, each pawn was given its own name. The low-life gangster pawn sat on the leftmost file, since left-handed people were considered evil in medieval Europe. The policeman pawn sat in front of the left-side knight, since knights trained the city guards. There was the innkeeper, who worked with the left-side bishop, the doctor who took care of the queen, the king's merchant, the bishop's clerk, the knight's blacksmith, and finally, old farmer pawn on the rightmost file. So, did these pawns gain any special powers for their occupations? Nope, it was just random backstory given to the pawns to make them more interesting. Another major spice added to the game was its many variants. One of the most famous variants was courier chess, also known as fairy chess. This was started in about the 12th century and was popular up until the 1800s. It was played on an 8x12 board, and as such, it had four additional pieces. The sage, which moved like a king but was allowed to die, the jester, or le fou, which moved diagonally, one square at a time, the two couriers, who moved like bishops, and the bishops, they moved diagonally only two squares. I suspect that this variant of chess was the reason that in France and some other countries, they got confused of what the bishop was supposed to be called, so that's why they started calling it a courier or a jester, because they were used to the fairy chess names. I think that for a time, courier chess probably superseded basic chess in popularity, and so, you know, in learning the rules of the game, they mistook the bishop as a jester. Regardless, these variants added new strategy and liveliness to this evergreen game. And just like the ancient Persians, the Europeans developed their own puzzles, books, and strategies, and started using the revolutionary new printing press in the 15th century to share rules and ideas with one another. One of the best of those books that still impacts chess strategy today was written by Ruy López de Segura, a Spanish priest, in 1561. He had just visited Rome and decided to pick up Questo libro è di imparare giocare a scacchi et le partite by Pedro Damiano, a Portuguese pharmacist. López thought that the book was trash, and he set about to write his own. In his book, Libro de la Invención Liberal y Arte del Juego del Ajedrez, he sets out the mythological origins of the game of chess, and then he discusses opening strategies, including openings that are still used today, such as the King's Gambit and the Ruy López, or Spanish opening. And finally, he spends the last third of his book roasting Damiano's analysis. Since the strategy was still a bit embryonic at the time, López has some strange ideas, such as playing so that the sun is in your opponent's eyes. Nevertheless, López was the greatest master of his time, regularly defeating the Italian priests who would challenge him. Over the succeeding centuries, the popularity of chess moved northward and would take strong root in 18th century France. Then, in the 19th century, passion for it thoroughly took hold in England and America. One great boost to its popularity was, according to chess.com, quote, in 1849, when Jacques of London, a manufacturer of games and toys, introduced a new style of pieces created by Nathaniel Cook. These same pieces were endorsed by Howard Staunton, the strongest player of his time. This new style of pieces, known as the Staunton pattern, became instantly popular and were used in tournaments and clubs all over the world. The Staunton pieces, and minor variations of it, are still considered to be the standard for tournament chess sets. Close quote. The standardized pieces, along with clocks becoming a regular part of tournament play, made the game very official and very exciting as it spread throughout the rest of the world. So why is chess important, especially to Western civilization? Well, for many reasons. First of all, like Western civilization itself, chess is a combination of ideas from the East, the Middle East, and the European continent that combine together to form something beautiful and unique. Chess, like all good ideas, was not spread through war or violence, but rather through commerce, trade, and friendly competition. Even in medieval times, it was an egalitarian game, notably enjoyed and mastered not just by aristocratic men, but also by women, priests, pharmacists, and commoners. Second, chess is a standard point of reference people across time and Western civilization understand and relate to. Much of our vocabulary and metaphors come from this game, so if you understand the game better, you'll understand your own culture and language better. For example, if your boss at work calls you a pawn, now you know he thinks you're disposable. Third, chess has played a key role in Western history. It pierced through the Iron Curtain during the Cold War in 1972, when the Soviets and the US made a tenuous peace agreement so that Fischer could play Spassky to determine who really was the world chess champion. Chess also was a key part of the development of computers, as the programmers of Deep Blue and other engines pushed the boundaries of computer science in order to defeat the great chess masters. Fourth, Chess fosters great values and skills that have been key to building and maintaining Western civilization. Some of those values are bringing people together across generations, sex, and class, teaching people how to win and lose, learning from your mistakes, focusing, honing your creativity, building your confidence, exercising your brain, learning to problem solve, and keeping calm under pressure. With that, we will end our episode for today. Thanks for listening to this special birthday episode for my wife. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a 5-star review and share this with a friend. For more information on this topic, check out the sources listed in the description. I'm Doug Archway, and that's history for you.